Since 1977, the unmistakable baritone voice of Merrill Reese has been the soundtrack for the memorable moments of the Philadelphia Eagles. The NFL's longest tenured play-by-play man celebrated his 40th season behind the mic in 2016. And to add to that celebration, he was inducted into the franchise's Hall of Fame last November. I began by asking Merrill how he first heard about his selection for this honor and the tribute that followed during a halftime ceremony at Lincoln Financial Field.
But the actual notification came to me last summer in a phone call from Eagles owner Jeffrey Lurie. He called me, and I figured, oh, Jeffrey Lurie's calling me. Maybe he's interested in a round of golf, because we both love to play golf. And he said, Merrill, I'd like to tell you that we have decided to make you a member of the Eagles Hall of Fame. And it was very, very emotional. It was something I had never really thought about. And it was just a great, great honor. And then it was announced later in the summer at a big dinner that the Eagles had, where they announced the Hall of Fame recipients being Jeremiah Trotter and me. It was a benefit dinner for autism, which is one of the Lurie family's biggest charities. And then, of course, the night itself was, well, actually, it was the whole fall of Hall of Fame weekend, with a brunch on Sunday morning for season ticket holders, and then so many activities the day of the game, and a lot of things taking place at the NovaCare Center, again with an appearance before a large crowd of people, and then a meeting with Jeffrey Lurie himself, and then limoed over to the stadium, and then do the game and rush down at halftime. And it was an amazing feeling. It was almost surreal, the ovation that I received from the crowd, and having an opportunity to say a few words, express my gratitude at this amazing honor that I received, and then back up in the booth and back to business. So it was a whirlwind, and it was certainly a wonderful feeling to get that kind of appreciation, and one that I will always be grateful to the Eagles for giving me.
So I want to go back before starting with the Eagles in 1977. You not only did sports play-by-play, but also hosted a music show at the radio station on the campus of Temple University. You did some newscasts as well after graduating from Temple. Was sports broadcasting in particular, always the ultimate goal, or did you have thoughts that your broadcasting career might take a different turn?
No, not really. It's always been sports. That's the reason I became a communications major. I was somebody who loved to play sports growing up. I played every sport imaginable. My biggest area of concentration from a personal standpoint as an athlete was tennis. I played a lot of tennis tournaments, but I loved every sport. The baseball season was special to me, and then I'd moved into the fall, and football was great, and basketball. I loved to play basketball. Would be one of these kids who would come home from elementary school and put on my old clothes and go back to the schoolyard and actually play basketball until dark. But it was always sports, and I used to, of course, I loved football so much. I used to dream about being a quarterback someday, and then I realized that at 5'8" and 140 pounds, it wasn't going to get me very, very far. So I the next greatest moment, greatest dream that I had was to someday be the guy up in the press box broadcasting the games, to be a play-by-play sports broadcaster. And that was what I always wanted. And then I chose my major. It was communications at Temple University. And when you get into the student station, you do whatever they have. So for a year, I guess I played some records and then was given an opportunity to do a Temple Philadelphia baseball game, became sports director at the student station, probably did 300 basketball games in my 4 years, because we didn't just do Temple games. We did every doubleheader at the Palestra. We had a broadcast line at the Palestra. So I do two games on Wednesday night. I do a Penn game on Friday night. I do a Palestra doubleheader on Saturday night. As a matter of fact, one day, one Saturday, they had a triple header in the afternoon of the high school, the Philadelphia City High School playoffs, and I did three high school games that Saturday afternoon, followed by a college doubleheader at night. So I did five games in one day. Oh, and I did Temple baseball, football, basketball. We did everything. So the music show was something that probably lasted for 6 months. It was a very, very minor part of my broadcast endeavors, and it was not really a goal of mine to ever do that. Although in my first professional job in Pottstown, Pennsylvania, I did have to spin records for a while in addition to doing newscasts. And then finally, when I got into the city, I had to take a job doing news at WWDB, and I begged them to let me do a sports show, and I was able to come in and do sports in the morning for free, and then come back in the afternoon from 12 to 8 and do news every hour and a half hour. So there are a lot of things you do in broadcasting to get that ultimate dream achieved, but my goal was always to be a play-by-play broadcaster.
From here on in, Pazarczyk can just fall on the football, and there is nothing the Eagles can do. And Pazarczyk fumbles the football. It's picked up by Herman Edwards. 15, 10, 5, touchdown Eagles! I don't believe it! I don't believe it! I do not believe what has occurred here, ladies and gentlemen. Talk about miracles, folks. I do not believe this one, but it has happened as the Eagles beat the Giants 19-17 before a shock crowd at the Meadowlands.
On to the Eagles in 1977, and over four decades, you've been witness to and called the significant moments in Eagles history, from the miracle of the Meadowlands in 1978 to the NFC Championship game over Dallas in 1981, to the most recent NFC title in 2005 over Atlanta, and then the amazing comeback against the Giants in 2010 with the DeSean Jackson punt return as time expired. Is there one memory that for you stands out above all the others?
You named it. That was December 19th, 2010 at Giants Stadium. It was Giants Stadium. I don't think they had called it MetLife quite yet. And it was the DeSean Jackson punt return that with the zeros on the clock as he crossed into the end zone. And that was it, because the Eagles were so bad in the first half of that game. I think I said the score is the Giants, whatever it was, 17. The Eagles are still at the hotel. But I was able to witness the greatest half of football I have ever seen performed by any quarterback before or since. The way Michael Vick grabbed a hold of that game and just took total control of it. It was amazing. I mean, he hit Brent Celek over the middle for a 64-yard touchdown pass to get them back. There was an onside kick recovered by Riley Cooper. It was Vic again running and passing and getting them downfield. A great touchdown by Vic on a quarterback draw, and then he took them back again and got them into the end zone on a pass inside the left pylon to Jeremy Maclin, and then they held the Giants, and then, of course, the punt return where it was went through the hands of DeSean Jackson, and he bobbled it and reached down and picked it up, and then the Red Sea parted, and he finally got into the end zone after dancing around on the one-yard line. So to me, that memory that you brought up, that was it. Miracle of the Meadowlands, part two, as we call it.
Takes it at the 35. Picks it up. Looks for running room. He's at the 40. He's at the 45. Midfield.
You know, when those games are dramatic and it's getting down to the wire, or in that case, a great comeback, I have to imagine it's both wonderful, because that's what you got into this profession for, and very much chaotic, because you're trying to be accurate, deliver the listener all the information you can while so much is going on.
It's not really chaotic. You are, at a time like that, you are in remote control. I think there are certain things that I concentrate during a broadcast. I call it the STDD, score time down distance. At all times, you want to make sure that your audience is apprised of the score, the time, the down, the distance. The last thing you want is for somebody to turn on a radio and hear this great game going on and have no idea of what the time is or what the score is. You've got to be aware of those things. But when the great moments happen, whether it was the original moment at the Meadowlands or whether it was Wilmer Montgomery's run in the first quarter against Dallas in that NFC Championship game on January 11th, 1981, whatever it is, the craziest things that you've ever seen, you at that time are totally on automatic control. I mean, you're just describing. That's when your instincts take over. That's where all of the disciplines that you learned as a broadcaster coming up kick into play, that you naturally describe things as you see them. You naturally keep yourself under control until the play has been completed, and then maybe you let loose. But that's what happens. Those are not moments that make or break a broadcaster. To me, the great broadcasters are people who are so fundamentally sound. And those bonus moments are really just that. They are the great moments that come just for being prepared and doing your job the way it should be done.
Staying along the lines with dramatic situations, the common phrase most fans associate with you is the way you say it's good when the Eagles connect on a big field goal.
The ball is spotted. The kick is away. It's got the distance. It's gone!
Can you recall how that started? Was it just a spontaneous reaction one time?
It was. It was a game, and I wish I had the exact year. Let me just think about the year. It was a year where the Eagles were playing in Seattle, and it was December 13th, 1992, and the game had gone. It was a rather, it wasn't a great game. It was a rather mediocre game in Seattle, and neither team played particularly well at the Kingdom, and they went into overtime. And there were no spark. It kind of limped into overtime, and nothing happened in the overtime until the final seconds of overtime. So that's five quarters of football, and with just seconds left in the game, the Eagles attempted a field goal. The kicker was Roger Ruzick, and when he hit that final field goal, I believe I exclaimed, "It's good!" And it was all of the pent up emotion that had been lying dormant for about 4 hours coming out, and that was the birth of "It's good." And I try not to overuse it. It really, when I extend it that long, it's a very, very special kick.
You have a very unique style. I mean, fans from any team would recognize you immediately. Also, being well prepared is key, as well as the ability to be informed. What do you attribute most to the reason you've been around for 40 years, as well as your popularity?
I don't think about that. I would imagine that it's the fact that the fans listening to the broadcast are feeling the same things that I am feeling, or that I am feeling the same things that they are feeling. Without trying to be a homer, I try to be honest. I have great respect for our listening audience. If the Eagles are playing poorly, I say they're playing poorly. I hate when people say, "Oh, you're a homer." To me, a homer was a statement that's not very flattering. That's a broadcaster who is trying to sell tickets. Everything is the favor of the home team. They never play badly. They're beaten by the officials. Every catch is a great catch. Every mistake you brush under the table. I think the fact is I'm honest. Now, that doesn't mean I'm stupid. That doesn't mean that I'm going to go rip a coach or rip an owner or rip a general manager, because there are certain ways that you can just absolutely undermine your career longevity. And I'm not going to do that. But I am as honest as you can possibly be in a broadcast. And I think it's the respect that I have for the fans and the ability I have to express with my emotions matching their emotions at a particular time that makes my style comfortable and enjoyable, hopefully, for them.
Even the best have their share of bloopers and mishaps. Do you have a particularly embarrassing on-air moment, perhaps in your early days, that you'd care to share?
Oh, I have probably had a particularly embarrassing moment every year, every year that I've broadcast the games. I mean, all of us do, because unlike print media people, we don't have a chance to edit. We don't have a chance to go back and go over what we said. But the one that I remember the most, I can't remember exactly what year it was, other than the fact that it was the Ray Rhodes Eagles, and they were playing in Dallas, and it was a game that was coming down to the final seconds, and the Eagles had the lead, and Troy Aikman marched the Dallas Cowboys down to about the 5-yard line, and with seconds to go, and the Eagles were up by just a couple of points. With seconds to go, Aikman threw a pass into the end zone. And at the time, we were at the Texas Stadium, looking way, 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 way down. And I could see an Eagles helmet go up above the crowd, and the hands extend, and the football intercepted. So I knew it was an interception, but he was completely screened, and I couldn't tell who it was. And so I was biding my time. I said, intercepted, intercepted. The Eagles had the ball. And now he's coming out of the end zone, and still he's blocked. And I cannot make out a uniform number. And I go, he's to the 5, he's to the 10. And as he's running along the sideline, I looked over at my spotter, who was Derek Boyko, who's now the Eagles' public relations director. And usually Derek, during that time, will have the binoculars down there, and he'll pick it up, and then somewhere along the run, I'll insert the name of the ball carrier. And Joe McPeak, our producer, who was always very professional, was so overcome and excited by the interception that he tackled Derek Boyko. And as I looked over at my spotter, the two of them were rolling around on the floor, and I looked onto an empty board. Now I look back up, and I saw number 23. And I said, it's Troy Vincent. Vincent at the 50, the 40. And I took a ball, and I went, the Eagles win, the Eagles win. And I said, what an interception by Troy Vincent. What I didn't realize was that the ball was actually intercepted by James Willis. As I looked down to get the spot, to get the player, the identification, Willis lateraled the ball to Troy Vincent, and it was actually Willis's interception and Vincent's return that created the whole thing, and I actually missed the lateral. So everybody felt terrible about that. My producer, my spotter, oh, we're sorry, we're going to resign. I said, don't worry about it. We all make mistakes. But I didn't want to hear that. I didn't want to hear it back. I felt during a commercial break, we saw the replay of that. We all wanted to die.
We'll get back to the show in a moment, but first a few words about Audible.com, the premier provider of digital audiobooks. Audible has over 180,000 titles to choose from in every genre: thrillers, business, romance, comedy, sci-fi, and more. Audible titles play on iPhone, Kindle, Android, and more than 500 devices for listening anytime, anywhere. For you, the listeners of this podcast, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with a free 30-day trial to give you the opportunity to check out their service. To download your free audiobook, go to audibletrial.com/profilesinsports. Again, that's audibletrial.com/profilesinsports, all one word, for your free audiobook today. Comparing from 1977 to today, has the way you prepare for a game changed much, even with the ability to access information more readily? Has your methods of preparation been that much different?
No, they really haven't. Other than the fact that, as you mentioned, I'm able to use my iPad to get tape and to look at offenses and defenses instead of borrowing cassettes and taking them home and putting them into my television. But other than that, they haven't changed. I work as hard as I ever have. It's a way of life. It's not just a job. I'm already looking at numbers on my way home from a previous road trip, and it's all the time. I mean, I'm there every day. I'm down at practice. I'm in the locker rooms. I'm talking to coaches, talking to players. I have shows on Monday nights and Thursday nights, and no matter how many shows I have or what time I get in, I could get in 11 o'clock at night, and I still need at least 2 hours in my study to continue my game prep. The only night I give myself off is Saturday night, Saturday when I really just freshen up. Either we travel, or if we're home, if it's a nice day, I'll play golf and go out for a quiet dinner the night before a game. But just give myself a break so that I'm fresh on Sunday. But it hasn't changed. The preparation is basically the same. Reading the clips, finding out what is said, everything about the opponent in at least their last three or four games, and just learning everything you possibly can, and getting up nervous on game day, leaving for the stadium for home game 4.5 hours before kickoff. If we're on the road, I'm on the bus number 5 with players and coaches, and it's basically the same. Come to the broadcast booth, very quiet. Don't eat once I get to the stadium because I'm far too nervous. Watch the warm-ups, see who's healthy, who's not, see the punters and which direction the wind is blowing, chart the kickers to see what their maximum distance in each direction is, everything that I have to do to be ready for the game. So in those past 100 years or however long it is that I've been doing the games, the preparation hasn't been affected, except it's easier, as you said, to access the information because of the computer age.
I'd like to touch on a couple of notable Eagle figures you've seen and been around over the past 40 years. The first being the late Buddy Ryan, once the defensive coordinator of the Bears, who coached the Eagles from 86 to 90. I can't imagine there were many boring days when he was around.
I love Buddy. Absolutely love Buddy. I wondered what he was all about when he first arrived. Difficult to get to know, but once he took you into his confidence, there was nobody like him. He was a great, great guy, and he was fun to be around. And I still think of so many things that when things occur, there's always a Buddyism that comes into my mind. It was Buddy who said, "Durability is as important as ability." So you know, with Buddy, there's always something that I think about. There's always Buddy's way. You can't win with itty bitty backs, or you know, and he was such a magnetic figure. He was so much fun to be around. Now, Buddy's mouth got him into trouble because you can't refer to the owner when you're trying to sign players as the guy in France. The guy in France would ever come back, we might have a team. You can't do that. You can't refer to the club president, Harry Gamble, at a dinner or a luncheon to begin the season as Bremen's illegitimate son. You can't do those things and get away with them. But Buddy was Buddy, and he was a treat to be around. Love Buddy.
Next is someone I would have to think is the most exciting player you saw in your time, and that's Randall Cunningham.
I would agree. I would give him that adjective, most exciting player. Not the best player, but the most exciting player. He was considered football's ultimate weapon. You never knew what he was going to do next, whether it was punt a football more than 90 yards or leap over a defender or throw a pass into the end zone when he was about 2 inches from being on the flat on his back. I mean, he was amazing. Yes, he would be the most exciting.
And from the quarterback of the late 80s and early 90s to the quarterback from drafted in 1999 to much controversy, Donovan McNabb, do you think McNabb and also Andy Reid have gotten the respect they deserve from Philadelphia for what they accomplished?
I think looking back, they have. I think looking back, because there's been such a drought that people are fully appreciating a coach that took a team to 5 NFC Championship games and a Super Bowl, and a quarterback who racked up the numbers and was as tough as Donovan McNabb. Donovan McNabb, just look at the records, the best quarterback in the history of the Philadelphia Eagles, or at least Eagles, Donovan McNabb, the absolute best quarterback that this team has ever had. So, I think most football fans can look back at those two and say they were really special.
Backs in an open center. They go up and over to Westbrook. McNabb fakes. He rolls. He throws. Complete. Touchdown, Brent Celek. McNabb faked and went to Brent Celek in the corner of the end zone, and the margin increases.
So from the Eagles of the past to the Eagles of the present and future, and this would be the last question for you, Merrill. Even though there are plenty of offseason needs, that with Carson Wentz having the look of a franchise quarterback, the vibe around Philadelphia probably is much different and much more positive than it was at the end of the previous season.
I hope so. Occasionally I'll read a writer who says, or I hear a commentator who says, well, we really don't know. Hopefully he is the franchise quarterback, or we'll find out ahead. The signs are positive. I'm not afraid to say it. They have their franchise quarterback. This young guy from North Dakota State is truly, truly special. He could turn out to be the best quarterback they've ever had. He has everything you need. He's got size. He's 6'5", 240. He's got a great arm. He's bright. He's diligent. He's a leader. I just think the sky is the limit for Carson Wentz. I think they've struck gold. I think he makes this past 2016 draft class a success, regardless of whatever happens to the other players. But he is that special. So I think this team has some holes, but I think every team has some holes. I don't agree that this team is years away or three drafts away. Things happen quickly in the National Football League. The Cowboys went from 4-12 to the number one seed in the NFC this year. The Giants went from a losing season to a team that actually made the playoffs. I don't think the Giants are better than the Eagles. I really don't. In fact, the Eagles beat the Giants the last time they played, and that was not a meaningless game. So I think the Eagles are heading in the right direction. I think Doug Peterson is a coach who is respected and liked by everybody in that building, including everybody in the locker room and his entire coaching staff. And they need to bolster the secondary, the corners. They need help there. There's no doubt that they can use another pass rusher that can really put heat on a quarterback. And we all know that they need a wide receiver who has downfield speed, who can separate, who can make the big catches. They need more playmakers, and they may even need another bell cow running back. But like I said, these things can be addressed between free agency and the draft. And the biggest thing is, they have some great players. They have a great defensive lineman in Fletcher Cox. He's a terrific, terrific player. They have a playmaker, a game-changing middle linebacker in Jordan Hicks. They have a tremendous safety in Malcolm Jenkins. They have a young player in Jalen Mills, who I still think could be an exceptional player as he develops. They have an outstanding tackle in Lane Johnson. We hope that his problems with the banned substances are behind him and that he can go in and get there from the beginning of the season and be the kind of force that he is on the offensive line. They drafted a couple of players last year in Isaac Ciabola and also Halapulavati Vaitai, who are going to be NFL offensive linemen. And they have Zach Ertz, can be a playmaker. We saw how good he was. I read somebody last week who said he played soft at the beginning of the season. He played with a broken rib. Of course he's not going to go out and look for extra contact. But Zach Ertz is a tremendous player. So I think this team has the basis of being a very, very good team. And I'm not talking about the distant future. If next year at this time this team isn't still playing football, or at least going into the playoffs, if they're not a playoff team, I will be highly disappointed.
Okay, well, I'm glad you have optimism. And certainly the key is they have a quarterback, and that's the hardest thing to have as a franchise quarterback, and they do have that.
Absolutely.
Well, Merrill, congrats on 40 years. Can't wait to hear you do many, many more. Thanks so much for your time today.
My pleasure, Brian.
I hope you enjoyed this latest episode of Profiles in Sports with Merrill Reese. If you'd like to hear all episodes of this program, which include discussions with Mario Andretti, Ken Burns, Jack Ham, and many others, please subscribe to the Profiles in Sports podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, Google Play, and elsewhere. Also, be sure to check out our website, profilesinsports.com, as well as our Facebook page. And lastly, you can follow me on Twitter, @BrianWright86.